I am Regina Lark. I am the Assistant Director for the Center for the Study of Women here at UCLA. I guess I'm being interviewed because I wrote a doctoral dissertation when I was a graduate student at the University of Southern California. It is titled, They Challenge Two Nations, Marriages Between Japanese Women and American Men, 1945 to the Present.
When did you write it?
I completed it in August of 1999.
Why did you choose this subject?
I chose this subject because I had a wonderful professor in graduate school who assigned a reading that we had to do for class, a book by Evelyn Nakano Glenn called Ise Nise War Bride. And her conclusion for the War Bride section of the book was that these women had basically very miserable lives. They were married to men who were inaccessible, and the women were very isolated and had no sense of community. The interviews, her study was based on interviews with 12 Japanese quote-unquote war brides who had been living in the United States approximately 30 years at the time of her study, and it was based on interviews with 12 women who worked as domestics for different households in San Francisco. So the study was very limited and very narrow in its focus, although important because no one has ever discussed the phenomenon of the war bride experience. And that term is kind of a misnomer for the women in the study, which I can explain why I think that. Why is it a misnomer? Well, when we talk about Japanese war brides as opposed to European war brides, European women who are called war brides were generally married through the through World War II, beginning at about 1939, when war was officially declared, and through the war to the end in 1945, and they're marrying, British women are marrying British soldiers or Australian, whoever was involved in the war. They're marrying during wartime. When Japanese women are getting married to World War II era soldiers, it's happening after the war finished. The Allied occupation of Japan begins in August of 1945. And it's within that first year that these marriages start taking place. So in a sense, they're military brides. Many of them do get married while the United States is engaged in a police action with Korea, with North Korea. However, since that was never an officially declared war, I don't know if I could call them war brides. But the commonly held term for Japanese women who are marrying World War II era soldiers and officers is war bride, but it just doesn't hold the same resonance as their as the European counterparts, if you will. Anyway, Dr. Glenn's study on war brides concluded that these women had miserable lives and that the men were a bunch of jerks. Basically, they didn't support their wives. They were very selfish. They were very hierarchical, very patriarchal. And I was stunned that she can draw such broad conclusions on a study with just 12 people. So I said to my professor, how can she draw such conclusions? She goes, you tell me. And that just set me off on a course of study. I was working at Cal State Northridge. I was a graduate student doing my MA at Cal State Northridge at the time. Talked to one of the part-time faculty there. I said, Bob, I'm so excited about this book that I read. I really would love to hear another story about this war bride phenomena. I said, so I'm going to start looking to see if I can find Japanese women who married American men. He goes, I did. And I said, no kidding. And he introduced me to his wife, Miwako Cleave. And I spent 2 days interviewing Miwako, and her story was as antithetical and opposite as one story could be to Glenn's study. I met somebody who was, at that time, earning six figures a year, working as fashion designer for Olga Lingerie Company. She supported her husband through his PhD, and on and on and on. She was the epitome of the American success story, if we were to use a colloquia. And it just undermined everything I had just read. So I thought, there's got to be more Miwako Cleaves in the United States. And then when I went to graduate school for the PhD at USC, I launched upon a more formal study.
So how many people did you interview?
35. And a number of the, I don't have the figures in front of me. It was primarily, it would be approximately 25 brides, quote-unquote brides, their spouses, the ones who were available to speak with me. And outside of the number 35, I also did two group-taped interviews with their adult children, the products of these interracial relationships.
We have a lot of questions, but let's focus on your dissertation first.
Okay.
So what's your conclusion?
My conclusion is not very exciting. I concluded that some of the marriages were happy, some weren't. Some were very normalized by American standards in terms of a very strong adherence to gender roles. The marriages, you know, some had problems in terms of adultery, alcoholism, and others are wildly successful and going on 55 years now. So in my study, there was no way to make any determination of good or bad. They just seemed typical of marriage everywhere. They did have a lot of issues early on, from language barriers to cultural differences to belief that Japan would never become a great nation, and so we've got to, a lot of the women just worked very hard to quote-unquote become American. They didn't teach their children the language, they adopted American foods, culture, language. They believed that they needed to fit in. So I think the first 10 years or 15 years of their relationships had components in them that would not be found with same-race relationships. However, as they got older and the children were growing up and they didn't have as much that they needed to adhere to as far as maintaining an American identity, they really moved over to embracing that which they saw made them Japanese versus American. The term American is being used here in very traditional ways. I truly don't know what it means to be American. We live in such a diverse, multicultural, ethnic. If anything, that's what it means to be American, is to be a very diverse society. However, these women, when they first come to the United States, the cult of American domesticity drops right into their lap. It's how to be a good wife and mother. It's to put family and husband first. It's to present a good home, to present a good front. And a lot of them worked very, very hard to do that, taking on American English language skills, driver's licenses, voting, becoming naturalized. But their relationships, I think, on the whole, over time, resembles any other relationship I've seen. They either communicate or they don't. Some of the women went on to get college degrees, some didn't, some divorced. I would say to a person, those who have children take great pride in their offspring and their offspring's accomplishments, just like any parent would. And some of the husbands learned Japanese, some fluently, some to the degree that they can say, I love you, hello, goodbye, thank you, and to have limited conversations with the wife's families. Some of the women were disowned when they married an American, and parents in Japan said, don't ever darken my door again. Some never did. Others were re-embraced by their family when they realized that their daughter was happy, or when their daughter stood by her decision. Some parents said terrible things to their daughter and took it all back. I mean, it was, there's not one way of looking at these relationships. There's a multitude of ways.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's start with how Japanese women started marrying American soldiers. I think there's historical roots, right?
There's, pardon me?
Historical roots. I started with the American occupation.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting story because the U.S. military presence anywhere in the world always meant that soldiers and local women would get together. When the occupation started in Japan, General Douglas MacArthur laid down an anti-fraternization moratorium that these two constituencies will not come together. It was an impossible order to uphold because not only was the U.S. military, the Allied forces, providing a million jobs, right, on bases as domestic servants, in the bars, the brothels, the laundries as gardeners. I mean, the occupation forces were one of the most major employers in Japan. In the churches, everywhere. Everywhere the occupation was, they employed local folks all over Japan in every instance. So anti-fraternization orders could not be upheld. What MacArthur does instead, I'm going to back up a second.
Also, year when it started?
The occupation started at the end of August of 1945. The war ended, I believe, on August, don't quote me, 21st. The occupation began a week later, maybe a little earlier it ended, in a very horrific, nightmarish way, as we all know, with the droppings of the atomic bombs. All through the U.S. war with Japan, the U.S. military and Washington and the media had to put an awful, awful spin on the Japanese people. There's a great historian, John Dower, who wrote a book called War Without Mercy. And he really looks at World War II as a race war, a war about race. And to look at the rhetoric coming out on the U.S. side toward the Japanese, the racially inscribed messages about who the Japanese people were created a situation where Americans, primarily Caucasian Americans, and I can explain why more white people than non-white people, but primarily whites in the United States grew to despise the Japanese because of their racial differences. And always had in the United States, we've always had very strong anti-Japanese, anti-Asian sentiment. So we build upon that, right? So we make the Japanese, the U.S. makes the Japanese to look as vile and as beast-like as they could. Well, the war ends, and now we're going to convince the American people that we're going to be spending millions upon millions of dollars in a place to quote-unquote democratize and demilitarize a people that had been our sworn former enemy. So how do we get the American people behind this idea that their sons and a lot of their sons, their husbands, and some of their daughters are going to be in a place for an indeterminate length of time? how do we convince Americans that they're going to be safe, that the Japanese aren't these beast-like creatures that they had been painted. And so what MacArthur does, who's the Supreme Commander of Allied Powers under the acronym called SCAP, it's we have to present a very different face of the Japanese, and it is going to be the face of children, docile, open to being civilized and tamed. And who's going to do this but our sterling American soldiers? You know, these young men that had grown up during the Great Depression and had morals and values. And so what MacArthur does is create a situation where let's photographers, let's the media come into occupied Japan and take photographs of his sterling American soldiers with doting, docile, childlike Japanese women. Japanese women are going to be seen as the ones of women and men in Japan. It's going to be Japanese women who are going to be seen as most receptive to democratic, quote unquote, democratic. The U.S. has a very odd way of displaying democracy, but that's a whole other discussion. But Japanese women are going to be seen as most receptive to democratic principles and ideas. In fact, when the new Japanese constitution is written in 1947, the whole family system of ai and of the hierarchy in the family is abolished. Women are encouraged to make love marriages rather than family marriages. Women are allowed to vote for the first time in 1947 with the Constitution. 39 women are elected to the Japanese Diet. I mean, it was a way to encourage women to adopt this idea of democracy. And they're used by SCAP to promote this, along with MacArthur's sterling upright soldiers. So initially, in the initial months of the occupation, there was a tremendous amount of fear on both parts of the Allied people and the Japanese. The Japanese were told all throughout the war that the Americans were these evil, warmongering, racist society, and the Americans were taught that the Japanese were the same. Basically. So there's a lot of, they're very leery of each other initially. Japanese women were instructed just before the occupation began to head for the hills, go to your family members, get out of the cities. Well, the cities had been so emptied by the B-52 bombings daily. The major urban areas in Japan had just been decimated during the war. The homelessness, the poverty, I mean, it was just tremendous, tremendous problems. But the women are instructed, head for the hills. The savage Americans are about to land, and we know what they do to women and children. And if you can't head for the hills, if you have no family members left in the countryside, shave your head, put on the most baggy, unattractive clothing that you can find, and appear as unassuming as you are able to, because these guys are going to snatch you off the street, and there's going to be hell. It's just going to be hell. So there was a tremendous amount of fear on the part of women and children and families, and I much to the credit of cooler heads. Was it MacArthur? I don't know. Was it pockets of leadership around Japan on the part of the Allies? I don't know. But in a very short period of time, the two groups, these two constituencies, right, the Japanese women, and these are women that had just lived through a horrific war. They had, so many of them had lost everything. There was an entire population of men missing. It was just such a horrific circumstance. They stopped going to school after a while, because schools were either being used for munitions factories. I can just imagine what those early days of the occupation must have been like because women are always pawns in war. Anyway, shortly after the occupation started, it was as if a sense of trust emerged. Tenuous, not very deep.
It's okay, there is...
I hit something here, sorry.
That's okay.
So a sense of trust emerges. And again, the Allied, the occupation forces are hiring Japanese citizens in droves to do the work of the occupation. And so women who had education were being hired as translators. Those who didn't were being hired as domestic workers. Some with a smattering of education, maybe high school, are being hired as secretaries, diplomats. They're being hired to take officers' wives on tours. They are attending base churches. If they're working on base, they're attending church. There's a lot of women who at different points in Japanese history in the 19th century, there was a lot of proselytizing and missionary work going on. So there was a number of women who had adopted a Christian faith. The churches had been bombed out. They're reemerging there. And there's also, the occupation forces funded heavily bars and brothels for their soldiers. And so women were getting jobs there as well. And so these are the spaces that they're meeting in. Some that have no moral value, and some that are seen as very proper places for women.
Okay, so, but I found out even though they met and dated, they were not allowed to marry.
Okay, they weren't allowed to marry. That's right. Well, they weren't allowed to marry. The party line was, we're not going to let you marry because you'll never be able to take your wife to the United States. Why can't you take your wife to the United States? Because the U.S. has these very restrictive, racially inscribed immigration laws that does not allow anybody of Asian ancestry to immigrate from a 1924 law. So these young couples would not be disappointed. You know, there was just an overall restriction on these marriages. The Japanese American Citizen League here in the United States began working very hard on behalf of Nisei soldiers who wanted to marry Japanese women. And they lobbied Congress so that in 1947, Congress passed the first of three, what I would call Japanese War Bride Acts, to allow for these couples to marry. Now, the first act in 1947 had a 30-day window of time where they could marry. And I'm going to back up a second. Congress did pass a fiancé, a service member's fiancé act, where a soldier could bring his fiancée to the United States. But again, we're dealing with the United States that had racially inscribed marriage laws. A very racist society, the U.S. is, as much as we pride ourselves in our heterogeneity and democracy. And so these fiancée acts just did not yield a lot of women coming to the United States. So 1947, they've got a Japanese War Bride Immigration Act, and the women and the men had to hustle to get their marriages approved. And that meant that the women had to undergo psychological testing, physical examinations. Whether these women had sex before, they're still having gynecological examinations. They're being asked very personal, intimate questions. Their third-grade teachers are being asked for affidavits to their good character, as was the neighborhood grocer. Test for tuberculosis. They had to pass a test to prove that they were not insane, that they did not have any mental disease or disorder. And rigorous and highly intimate and embarrassing hoops that they had to jump through. Some of the women just said, I can't take this anymore. Some of their families had disapproved to such a degree that the women faced with that type of anger from their parents. Now here are women who are about to marry Japan's most bitter enemy. So the surviving parents, and again, they lost so many people in this war, well over a million, they just can't figure their daughters out. As a result of the 1947 Act, the 30-day window of time, and how much work these couples had to do in order to get their marriages finally, and they also had to meet with the military base chaplain. And it was the base chaplain's report that could make or break the relationship. Approximately, I don't have the figures in front of me, under 25 marriages made it through, and maybe 19 immigrated as a result of that. And that was it. Boom, 30 days is over. Mike Masaoka, president of the JACL at the time, argued before Congress saying, are you saying that Japanese women are only good to immigrate for 30 days and that's it? You've got to extend this law. And so the JACL just kept lobbying. In the meantime, two things are happening. It's not just Nisei that are meeting and falling in love with these women. It's Caucasian men, it's African American men, it's Mexican American men that are doing the same. So while the JACL is lobbying on behalf of Nisei, it's growing. The phenomenon of these types of relationships is growing. And one reason why I call it a phenomenon is what is going to happen is these marriages are going to represent the first and the biggest group of interracial marriages that occur well after the passage of two really important laws in the United States. The first one was the 1690 Anti-Miscegenation Act, which held that Caucasian and non-Caucasians could marry in the United States. This is on the books until 1967. So from 1690 to 1967, we have a law that says whites and non-whites are not allowed to marry. California, Washington, and Oregon are going to be the first states in the U.S. to overturn these racially inscribed marriage laws. And that's going to happen toward the end of the 1940s, 1947-48. And the other event is that these marriages are going to take place well before these women are allowed to immigrate, I don't want to say freely, but before another major piece of immigration legislation, the McCarran-Walter Act, which finally lifts these racially inscribed immigration barriers. So these women are pioneers, brave, hardy souls, I think. Some soldiers' families wrote to their Congress members saying, my son has fallen in love, she's a wonderful girl, she'll be a welcome addition to our family, and we really hope that you can do something for us. So every now and again, in my research, I came across these private bills that a Congress member from Nebraska or Ohio or other states where interracial marriage was outlawed would put before Congress and have a private bill passed that soldier can bring that woman to the United States. And then their marriages, and then, I'm going to have to back up a second, they could bring them to the United States after the passage of other Japanese war bride acts that's going to happen in 50 and 51, which lifts that racial barrier for a year window of time each time until McCarran-Walter in 52, which finally lifts the barrier. So every now and again you see these private bills that allow for the immigration of a singular Japanese woman. But it's not until 52 that these marriages can happen in a much greater number than they did during the first few years of the occupation. In 52, the Korean conflict is winding down. most soldiers are in Japan, not as an occupying force now, but as an allied force because of the U.S. relationship with Japan then and now, I believe. And so a great many more marriages happen after 1952. There'll be several hundred during each time you have these Japanese war bride acts pass through Congress. But after 52, it's just, they still have to undergo the psychological, physical testing. They still have to have affidavits to attest to their moral character. And they still have to meet with a base chaplain, and the chaplain determines if this marriage is going to succeed or not. The notes by these chaplains, many of whom they saw a mixed race sitting before them, and they're of the school that that's just not going to work out, and try to discourage. Some saw a Japanese woman and a Nisei or Sensei soldier, and just assumed that the marriages would work out because they're of the same race, ethnicity. Now, a Nisei or a Sensei is, you know, no more Japanese, right? They're born and raised in, you know, Long Beach. So it's like, nonetheless, they saw them as similar, so of course you're similar, you can get married. But it was a very, what the women described to me was very difficult, and they're looked upon as prostitutes, no matter what their occupation, right? The women who were singing in the church choir and fell in love with the African-American soldier sitting in the fourth pew on the right, if they're seen walking hand in hand in the Gaza and in the Ginza, Gaza, no, they're going to be seen as women who are prostitutes or a gold digger. There's not, and so the pressure of all of that, plus the examinations, plus having your family get behind this idea, not everybody made it through the entire process. And then you're going to have, you know, a handful of women who are doing this to get out of a bad situation. You're going to have the handful of men who are doing this because they're just big liars and users of women. There's going to be that element too, but my study shows me that these couples who met and marry were on the up and up. They fell in love, they wanted to have a family, they wanted to have a good life, and they had to go through a lot in order to do that.
So the Japanese women were not able to enter the U.S. Even after, right after the War Bride Act.
They could.
25.
No. 25. No. Right. Well, I mean, no. I mean, the first War Bride Act, they could immigrate, but they had to have completed that whole process. Well, they only had 30 days.
Yeah, but you said this happened like 1947.
Yeah, I don't know of a War Bride Act of a Japanese War Bride Act of 45.
No, it's just a War Bride Act for everybody, actually, except like Japanese brides, Korean bride. Well, there's no Korean bride at the time, but like it's a European brides.
Right. Right, and Japanese. You know, what's interesting is the United States treatment of European war brides was so much more welcoming than the Japanese. The American Red Cross had a very big role in bringing European brides to the United States. They commandeered brides' ships where the women would, European brides, French, British, German, and again, you know, German war brides. Well, Germany was our bitter enemy during World War II. We got over that very quickly for some reason, and maybe because of their race. Anyway, but bride ships would bring the women to the United States, and these were like honeymoon ocean liners. I mean, they really treated the women well, and there were American Red Cross nurses on board to help with babies that might have been born during the war. I mean, heating up bottles and just a very a very different welcome for the European women. Once they got to the United States, the American Red Cross would help them locate the family members. I mean, it was just very different. When the Japanese women were marrying GIs, there were no bride ships. And the American Red Cross has a very different role. While the women, after the women passed through all these hoops, they had the exam, the base chaplain agreed to their marriage. They actually got married on base before they were sent to the United States, either in advance of their new husband's tour of duty having ended, or when the tour of duty ends and now they're both leaving at the same time to go. The American Red Cross sponsored what were called bride's schools. And it is at these bride's schools that Japanese women learned the domestic arts of American housewifery. And really, it was as pedantic as how to use a hairbrush. I mean, the lectures were just, in some ways, the most ridiculous thing. In my research at the National Archives in Maryland, I came across a run of Japanese brides' schools handbooks. The left side of the page would be written in English, the right side of the page would be written in Japanese, and it was everything from how to tell if you're pregnant to brushing your hair to what to wear when you're doing housework to how to cook American foods, a lot about American appliances, religion, nothing about race relations, nothing. Not what these women would encounter. There was an assumption that the husbands were Christian. Many assumptions about what these women would encounter. Very, very class-based. It was officers' wives primarily teaching these classes. And the wives come from a very different class structure in the U.S. And a lot of these women, regardless of whatever class they were born into, the war just changed all of that. And Japan, in many respects, I would guess, becomes a classless society for a time while they're picking up the pieces. So there's amazing photographs that I came across of the women just so excited to see a vacuum cleaner or a knife sharpener. They were taught to serve salad. They were taught to present their... if they came to the United States with Japanese kimono or lacquerware, to bring it out on special occasions. I took a lot of, back up, my research, there's a component of my research that talks about containing Japanese identity. And a historian by the name of Elaine Tyler May wrote a book called Homeward Bound. And it's life in the U.S. after World War II. And she talks a lot about this idea of containment of sexuality, containment of female independence. Women were very independent during the war. Not everybody, of course, but a lot of women are doing war work. They're out of the home, earning decent wages. And when the war ends, it's, you know, contain the family in the new single-dwelling suburban homes, on the new cul-de-sacs, contain the family in the living room around the television. And I took this idea of containment a step further on how the Japanese women's lives were prescribed. Contain your Japanese identity, contain your language, contain your accoutrements of what it means to be Japanese behind the cupboard. Only take it out for a special occasion. Contain this idea of self. And this is how the women are coming to the United States, with that, this idea of compartmentalizing what it meant to be Japanese and just contain it on the side. This is not something you bring forward. Sure, one look at you and we'll be able to tell you're Japanese. But if you do these certain things, if you keep a good home, if you serve salad before every meal, if you learn how to make a pot roast and flip a hamburger, if you learn how to make a bed, then no one will really know that you're different or other. They were shown videos called America the Beautiful and Little Johnny's Day and what the inside of a grocery store looks like. And they weren't told, really, about America-race relations. And these women are going to immigrate to the United States, and they are going to visit bedroom communities all over the country that had never even seen a Japanese person before. They're going to live primarily in the western regions because these are where the anti-miscegenation statutes had been passed, or they're going to live on military bases. If their husband re-enlists, which a lot of them did because of the benefits, because we're in a job shortage, housing shortage, right after the war, you know, through the 50s here in the U.S. So if they, if the husbands re-enlist, the women will live on bases with other mixed-race couples, so there was a sense of sameness there. And but they're going to be visiting their husbands' families when they first come here. A lot of the guys were from the South. They're going to find themselves in Columbia, South Carolina, not knowing what the hell they do with the colored or the white water fountain, where to sit on buses. Their families are describing them in very racially inscribed terms. One couple showed me the wedding announcement in the local paper in South Carolina, and she was referred to as the little Japanese butterfly in one part and the doll bride in the other part. And sure enough, you know, she's in this photograph. She's got a kimono on. She was not a large woman. And the way the camera was angled, it looked like this guy had just married a little girl. It was astounding because I believe a lot of folks here in the United States see what they want to see. Phones a solicitor would knock at the door, the Fuller Brush person, and look at the Japanese woman and say, "Is your mommy home?" You know, they see what they want to see. And so these women were faced with issues that they had not been prepared for in the bride schools, and they jumped through those hoops with a tremendous amount of determination and courage, I think.
I want to go back to those issues, but before I forget, I want to ask about term, war bride.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a proper term to use? Because I've been talking to some Japanese bride, and some people say, you know, I don't like the term.
Yeah. A lot of women believe that the term still connotates something negative, primarily that these women are gold diggers, they're users, or they were prostitutes. And so they shy away from that. Anybody who, I became very involved with a organization called the Nikkei International Marriage Society. And it's basically an international Japanese war bride club. They're on five continents, they've got hundreds of members, but because a lot of the women were still so associated, they still associated the term war bride with something negative, that the president of the organization, Kazuko Omezu Stout, is very proud that she's a war bride, and she uses the term all the time, but she was very sensitive to how other women might feel, and made sure that the title of the organization, the Nikkei International Marriage Society, did not indicate that these women had married during a military occupation.
So it's like a war bride or a military bride or something like that?
I think military bride would be more acceptable. I know that among a lot of the women associated with this organization, felt that the term war bride was just very negative. And it's so funny, too, because when I interviewed their adult children, I remember sitting with them at this convention I went to with all of them in Tokyo. And I remember being very astounded by the fact that they probably didn't even think of their mothers as war brides or military brides or brides, period. They were just mom. And they were so taken with the idea that their mothers, their moms, were worthy of very intense study, you know, because they were just like, this is mom. I don't see her as being other than that. However, when these adult children accompanied their moms to this war bride convention in her homeland, and the women, I heard story after story of the women finally opening up and talking about the circumstances of their childhood, their teenagehood, their youth, their young adulthood, their circumstances around their marriages, what they had to go through. These adult children really walked away from this particular convention with a very, very different sense of their moms and saw them as historical figures worthy of study. It was amazing to watch that transformation on the part of these adults.
Could you tell me how many Japanese women who married U.S. soldiers are here, I mean, so far, starting from 1947 and then... Do you have statistics on that?
Who are still around?
No, I mean...
How many immigrated?
Yes.
Oh, I don't have those statistics at hand. I know that the U.S. is still occupying bases in Japan and in South Korea. As long as that occurs, there will always be these types of marriages. So I would say tens of thousands of these marriages... are here in the United States, and or they're just stationed abroad and they just haven't, you know, finished the tour of duty and come here yet. I do know of, when I was in Japan at this particular convention, I did meet a handful of Caucasian, of retired military that never came back to the United States, loved Japan, the culture, the language, their wives and their wives' family so much that they stayed in Japan and continued to live there. So it's really, really hard to tell the numbers of the marriages that took place. And then immigration statistics can tell us just how many are right now.
So far, historically, from 1940 to the present.
I came up with a figure of, let's see, probably 60,000, 40 to 60,000. I know others put the number at much higher, and I just look at immigration statistics more than anything. Are those the most accurate? I think so, but then again, you can, if you're not coming from Japan and you're coming from someplace else, but you're Japanese and you married an American, then I think those statistics could be much higher. But certainly my study, I stopped, my interviews ended. I didn't interview anybody who married after 1959 because I didn't want to get into the whole Vietnam era because, you know, the U.S. is going to be stationed in Japan all through Vietnam, U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and, of course, Japanese and non-Japanese marriages are going to take place then. It just would have, I would have never ended my study if I hadn't stopped somewhere. So I put the statistics when my study begins in 45 and ends in 49 in terms of meeting and marrying, not necessarily immigrating, I put the number at approximately 40,000 in that 14-year period of time.
Where are the USA bases, Army bases in Japan? Is it mostly in Okinawa?
Osaka, Tokyo. There's a very strong military presence right in the heart of Tokyo right now. I'm not sure where others are. I'm not involved in the study still.
That's okay. I just want to get some picture.
Yeah.
And I think you already mentioned about this, but let's talk about the Japanese women, what kind of difficulties they faced there in America, and then what kind of achievement they had.
Well, the difficulties, I believe, surrounded a couple of things. Language was very big. Culture was very big. The inability to communicate verbally with their American-born husbands must have been tremendous. Families, extended families in my study, and I'm sure, again, I only interviewed, you know, out of the tens of thousands that are here, I didn't interview 1,000 even. But in my limited study, the husbands' families seemed to be welcoming after a short period of time when they finally stopped reeling from the fact that their son is not marrying the blonde, blue-eyed girl next door, but is bringing home somebody who used to be the enemy of the United States. They get over that fairly quickly and try hard to help their new daughters-in-law adapt to American ways. It was never about what can we learn from the daughter-in-law about her life in Japan. It's what can we teach her about America. It was not a two-way street, in other words. The initial reaction of the communities that they move around in, one of the women told me she was in a grocery store with her daughter, and she leaned over and said to her daughter something like, as a matter of fact, and an English-speaking woman mistook what she said and thought that the woman was giving the F word, a slang term, and this Caucasian woman smacked my informant behind the legs with a cane that she was carrying and said something like, "How dare you?" Being mistaken for a child when you're an adult woman. It, again, this idea of U.S. cultural perception of, you know, of race, of and living in a very racist society. I mean, in Japan, it's a very homogeneous landscape. In the United States, is a grand experiment in diversity. And so those kinds of differences. But again, the women reported that their neighbors warmed to them quickly. The kids had a hard time because the kids are mixed race, and they just didn't know where they fit in. Later on, some parents wished that they had taught their children more about what it meant to be Japanese. So the kids have a hard time trying to fit in. But the women, language, culture, food, a lot of them were lonely because they just don't really have a whole lot of people around them to talk with. And unless their husbands tried very hard to learn from the women, I think a lot of them were very lonely at the beginning of their time here. But I heard over and over again, this was the bed that they made and that they're going to lie in it. If the marriages had gone sour, if the husbands were adulterers or abusers or alcoholics, some of the women stayed in these relationships in ways as long as women in the United States. It really depended on what kind of resources they felt that they had available to them to allow them to leave this marriage. Wanting to should we just wait?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I have a
to look good in the eyes of their children. They were frustrated by the fact that they didn't know how to explain the school lessons. One woman told me that her daughter, in tears, when her daughter was 6 years old, she had to buy a ruler for first grade. She needed to bring a ruler in, and the mom did not know what a ruler was. And the girl, the daughter, is trying to explain it to her, and the husband is a Navy guy, and he's overseas. And so she was just, her frustration over not knowing the language, her daughter's frustration of not being able to communicate with her mother, and the loneliness that that must have entailed, I would imagine, was very, very difficult for all of them.
What about their communities and achievement?
Again, it's not until they're a little later in life that they start finding community. And because you have such high numbers living in the Western United States, they're eventually going to find each other. There's a huge cultural change in the U.S. in the 60s and the 70s, a big shift in how we look at race and diversity and ethnicity. And there seems to be a sense of safety in being able to be more expressive of what it means for them to be Japanese. So they are starting to branch out. They're going to poetry clubs. They're joining Japanese American community organizations. They're being asked to speak at JACL meetings. And they are going on to get college degrees. They're publishing newspapers. They're being independent. They are traveling, and they are working very hard to move their children forward. A lot of them will tell you that they take one of their biggest achievements is the success of their children. They also are community organizers. They're spreading Japanese culture in their hometowns. They're participating in local parades, Memorial Day, Labor Day parades. You know, these very homespun events that happen throughout Americana. They're participating with their own idea of what they say means to be American. And for them to be American is to be expressive of their Japanese-ness. They are holding tea ceremonies. They are teaching flower arranging. They're taking the domestic arts that they were taught as young girls and creating a whole new way of looking at them and teaching young women today on these arts, and older. They're also very involved. If they're living around military bases, they're involved in the lives of newly married Japanese women and military. Their names are in the personnel offices of the bases. If a young military bride is coming and living in Seattle, or Tacoma, or where a lot of U.S. Bases are, and they're having a hard time, the women will be called in. They go, I know, I was there. Here's what helped me. Sometimes they even suggest that the husbands were big liars and, you know, leave, go home, you know. They're also very determined to help these women, these newly marrieds, to make their marriages work, because they know that a lot of their reaction to their new circumstances is based on fear or feelings of being lonely. And so these women act in a way that some of them had told me they wish was was available to them when they got here. So they try to help ease the transition of a lot of these newly married Japanese women who are finding themselves in a place like Tacoma for the very first time.
I have two more questions.
Sure.
This is a little bit tricky question. So there is an image of women who married U.S. soldiers as prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some are actually, and mm-hmm. some are not, right? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with those images?
I'm not sure what you mean. Mrs. Stout, the president of the Nikkei International Marriage Society, she told me once, Regina, who can judge? If they did work as a prostitute in Japan, who could judge? They had families to feed. There was no other means of support. You can earn more money in a brothel than you could in a factory. She said, who are we to judge where they come from? What we're here to do now is to elevate them today. I think that any woman can, you know, we have this dichotomy when it comes to being female anywhere. You're either a good girl or you're a bad girl. We still, U.S. women are confronted with this too. If you have multiple sex partners, you're a whore. If you don't, you're frigid. I mean, women everywhere are viewed as either or. So when I think about how others might perceive Japanese women, I contextualize it. Well, what's the difference? I mean, why are we looking at Japanese women who marry Americans any different than we look at any other women? You're stigmatized, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. I don't see that. It hurts my heart that a lot of the women believe that stigma is still on them or surrounds them in some way. I want to shake American society. But I believe that these women are nothing short of courageous and quite remarkable and brave. I really think that they enter into an American society that saw them as the enemy, that had never seen a Japanese person, in a very racist society. And those of them who stuck it out and adopted the United States as their homeland, I find to be quite remarkable. And so my job is to keep telling the good story, as Mrs. Stout says. I asked her one day, I said, why do you suppose no one's ever talked to the war brides? And she goes, nobody wants to hear the good story, Regina. They always want to hear the bad story. They want to hear that we're prostitutes. They want to hear that we're sad or that we're misunderstood. Nobody wants to hear that we're successful, that we are part of our communities, that we love our families and our husbands, and that we, you know, that we're just, you know, women in our twilight years who, you know, have lived their lives as best as they can.